Tonight we'll be discussing the first parak in Avodah Zarah and try to understand a lot of references which the Mishnah and Gemara refer to. The Mishnah and Gemara, of course, were not written in a vacuum. They're written in a reality, in a real world which existed then. And in order to fully understand and grasp the meaning, we must understand what the reality was then, and of course apply it to nowadays and see whether, in which cases it's applicable and which cases not. The typical cases of the Mishnah was written during and after the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. So we'll assume that we're talking about, we're going to use the common era dates because they're more convenient, and the Mishnah was completed in the around the year 200, compiled by the Yehuda HaNasi. The Roman Empire captured Eretz Yisrael and the area in the year 63 BCE. And controlled the country for 100 years before destroying the Beis HaMikdash. Beis HaMikdash was destroyed in the year 6870 CE, and continued to control the country afterwards. In the 4th century, a major change took place when, until the 4th century, the Romans were pagans, and they worshipped idols. In the 4th century, the Roman Empire as a whole adopted Christianity, and when they adopted Christianity, the entire empire became Christian. And that is known as the Byzantine period, which begins in Eretz Yisrael from the year 325 approximately, and continues until the year 638, when Eretz Yisrael was captured by the Muslims. So the Mishnah is talking in the period when the Romans were actually idol worshippers, and that was the reality of the that was the reality in which the Mishnah was written, as we said. Now, the Romans made a major change to the face of the earth. The construction they made a change. The methods they used, we'll mention two methods, particularly two tools which they used particularly. One is the invention of concrete, and two is the perfection of the Roman arch. And these things enable them to build massive buildings, massive structures, stories high, something which was impossible beforehand. Now, the truth of the matter is that the Roman architecture is actually a follow-up of the Hellenistic architecture, the Greek architecture, but it came to perfection. Now, we're going to use a bunch of sources, but again, it's not a shear in Roman architecture or classical architecture. It's a shear in the Mishnah, and we're going to try to bring that reality to you, and for that, we're going to use a bunch of the archaeological sites which are mentioned, which we know of today, which have been excavated, some more, some less, and we're going to use those to show what the Mishnah is referring to. Now, these archaeological sites are not merely archaeological sites, but some of these sites are the sites where these events mentioned in the Mishnah actually took place. So in other words, we're going to refer to two cities in particular, which we'll get to in a moment. These are cities that some of the incidents which you learn in Masechet Avodah Zarah actually took place over there. As we said, the Roman architecture made a major change. It started with the Greek architecture. We'll go back a little earlier to the biblical times, to Tanakh times, when the cities were on hills and fortified, and the major part of the hill was usually either a king's palace or a form of a temple. But the Hellenists, and later, as I said, the Romans, perfected this. They changed the whole trend of thought. And the cities became cities for the convenience of the population, and not for the convenience of the king. They needed much larger cities. The hills were no longer large enough. And plus, the security concept also changed. Instead of each city fortifying itself, it came to a concept of fortifying the boundaries, and the cities can live peacefully, some even without any walls around it. And the cities from then on moved from the hilltops, what in Hebrew is called the tell, the ancient hills, down into nearby valleys and began there. So pretty much all the biblical sites in Eretz Yisrael, almost, not all, but a lot of them, most of them, ended at the time of the Hellenistic Roman period. And the Hellenistic Roman period, the city relocated to a convenient spot nearby. Now these changes were fascinating. And we even find in Chazal the question of how to approach these changes of the Roman architecture. We'll start on your Hebrew, on your page of sources. Source number one leads you to a document which has a list of Hebrew resources. And we'll start on that page of Hebrew resources, resource number 1.2, which is actually a Gemara in Avodah Zarah, Daf Beis Amud Beis, so we'll start with that. The Gemara tells the story of how Lasid Lava Hashem will take the Roman, will take a Sefer Torah, and say whoever was Osek in Torah should come and get his reward. And the first ones who come forward demanding reward are the Romans. And here we get to read from the text, Amar Lam HaKadosh Baruch Hu B'Maya Saktan. And Hashem says to them, what have you done? Amar Lepanav, they say, Ribono Shalom, Haber Shevachim Tekninu, we made a lot of marketplaces. Haber Merchatzaos Asinu, we made a lot of bathhouses. Haber Kesef Izahav Asinu, Herbenu, we added lots of, we gathered gold and silver. V'chulam Lo Asinu, El B'Shvi Yisrael, Kadesh Yisrael, Kadesh Yisrael. So the Romans come and say, we've done these special things we've done. We've made marketplaces, we've made bathhouses. Now that's their pride and joy. There's a similar Gemara, and go back to source number 1.1, there's a similar Gemara in Masechah Shabbos, Daf Lama Gimel Lama Beis, a very famous Gemara, where the Gemara relates that Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Shimon were having a discussion, and a person named Yehuda ben Galen was sitting, was there. Rabbi Yehuda said, how beautiful are the actions of this nation, referring to the Romans. Tiknu Shabakim, they made marketplaces. Tiknu Gesharim, they made bridges. Tiknu Mechatzos, and they made bathhouses. Rabbi Yossi Shasak, Rabbi Yossi heard this, and he was silent. Man of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai said, nonsense. Kol ma she'tiknu ha'tiknu ha'tok atzmo. What are you giving them credit that they made such a nice society and enabling us to live better? All they did was offer their own personal wealth. Tiknu shvakim, loshev and zonos. They made marketplaces, have prostitutes, mechatzos, la'adim b'matzman. They made bathhouses for their own pleasure, kesharim, litom, and mechat. And bridges to collect taxes, to collect tolls from the bridges. So we see over here the different approaches that Chazal had to this modern world which the Romans had done. Of course, both sides are true. On the one hand, the world modernized with the bathhouses, with the marketplaces, and the bridges. It enabled things to move quicker. But of course, the Romans did it for their own use. We're going to begin, as I said, with two major cities which have been excavated in Eretz Yisrael, and the two cities which have been excavated very nicely are Caesarea, Caesarea, and Beit She'an. These are two Roman cities, which as we'll see, about found over there. Fact, exactly what these things say in Chazal of a Roman city. I'd like to start off with source number 16, sketch of the center of Roman Beit She'an. Are there any questions until now? What? Okay, in order to understand this this sketch in detail, I will quote to you another very interesting medrash. This is in the Hebrew sources, source 1.4, from the medrash in Shmos Rabbah. A very interesting source. The source is giving a marshal. Now, the medrash is trying to explain something. It's giving a marshal, Kagan Eved Bas of Adam, a servant, a human servant, Shamala Adono, Hemteni Bashok. His master told him, wait for me in the marketplace. He didn't tell him where to wait in the marketplace, but just wait for me in the marketplace. So this slave, this servant is walking through the marketplace, and he's in awe from all the buildings, the Roman construction. So the Eved says to himself, he meant that I should wait next to the basilica. Amar li lamtina. Oshema es el beis hamechot. Maybe he meant to me to wait next to the bathhouse. Oshema betzad pitron. Teaton amar li. Maybe he meant that I should wait next to the theater. Mitzal such a mistar. The master found him and he slapped him across the face. Amar lo ashal. I sent you to the palace, I sent you to the gate of the palace of the governor, not to any one of these three sites which I mentioned here, which is the bathhouse or the basilica or the theater. If we get to the city of we get to the image of the Roman Beit Sha'an over here. Take a look at number one on the bottom right, and that is the theater. That is the theater that has been fully excavated. This is the center of Roman Beit Sha'an. If you take a look on the upper left corner, you see a sign that says Tel Beit Sha'an. That is the biblical side of Beit Sha'an. And the ancient story, the Tanakh stories of Beit Sha'an happened above on top of that hill, which is not seen here in the picture. But the city in the Roman days moved down into the valley and became a very large city, much larger than the hill itself. And what you're looking at is basically the center of Beit Sha'an. Today, if you visit Beit Sha'an, you can see all the stuff very clearly. And again, number one is the theater, which is on the right. We'll get to discuss that soon. Number three, which is a little to the left of the theater, is the bathhouse. The basilica is a little hard to see over here, but if you find number 20 in the center of the picture, go up a little straight up and the, towards 18, and that's the beginning of the basilica. So if you're looking at the center of Beit Sha'an, you can clearly understand the dilemma of this servant where to go. Now, if he's in the center of Beit Sha'an and he sees all these magnificent buildings, he doesn't know where the master expects him to wait for him. Okay, we'll start explaining some of these concepts. Number one was the open marketplace, which was either called the forum or the agora in Greek. This was an open market, which was the center of commerce in the center of the city. We'll start with the buildings of the basilica. The basilica is a very interesting building. Go to source number 17, if you can bring up source number 17. This is a, I'll give you a couple seconds to bring up the picture. The two on the left are diagrams of the of basilicas which have been excavated in Eretz Yisrael. A basilica is a long building with pillars, and as you can see at the end, a semi-arch or an apsis. Now, what was the purpose of the basilica? The basilica was an indoor building and a large building. As we mentioned, there's an outside marketplace. But of course, an outside marketplace is not always very convenient. Sometimes it could be rainy, it could be cold, sometimes it could be very hot. And in those days, the commerce moves in to the basilica. At the end of the basilica, there's another function, and that is the apsis. And there, the magistrate, the judge sits, and that's where court cases take place. So the basilica actually is dual functioning. It's one is the basic everyday life is going on at one end, and the other end is where the magistrate sits. Now the word basilica appears, in Avodah Zarah appears in Avodah Zarah in the Mishnah, and that's the Zayin Amud Aleph. Ein bonim mimayim basilki. The Mishnah forbids building a basilica because the basilica was used to sentence people to death, people who were not worthy of death penalty, and therefore you cannot participate and build together. You cannot build for the Roman government a basilica because you're actually assisting in what they are doing, which they are killing innocent people. Take a look at the Hebrew sources, source number 3.1. And this is a very interesting thing about the basilica. This is the Gemara in Yom Adav Kafei. And it says over here, Amav Sheshes Nominal Netanya, Lishkas Agazis, Kimin Basilki Gedola Haisot. the Lishkas HaGozes, the Chamber of the Union Stone, where the top Sanhedrin, the top courts of the Jewish people sat in the Beis HaMikdash, was built like a large basilica. Pais v'mizrach. Now, we're not going into full details, but in the Beis HaMikdash itself, the Kohanim used to perform the daily ritual, Beis HaKorbanos, and sometimes it's necessary to make a lottery to see who will get the rights to do that specific day's work. And in the eastern part of the Lishkas HaGozes, the eastern part of the basilica, there'll be that's where the lottery took place. The Zaken Yoshev B'Marev, but the elder sits in the western part of the basilica. So in other words, again, it is a typical Roman basilica which has dual functioning. One is the rituals which are going on, the everyday things which are going on in the eastern part of the Lishkas HaGozes, the basilica. While at the end is where the elder sits, in other words, he's sitting in the place where the Sanhedrin actually sits. And that's what you see on the diagrams over here. On the top left one is a basilica which was discovered in Ashkelon, and the one beneath it was a basilica discovered in Shomron. Both, again, the same thing, a long building, you see the pillars around, and at the edge you see the apse, which, again, as I said, for the magistrate. On your right, you see a reconstruction of a basilica which is not found in Eretz Yisrael, but Southern Europe, and to give you the idea. I'll also send you to another very interesting link, link number 22. Link number 22, the Lishkas HaGozes, and it might take you a couple seconds to load. Might take a couple seconds to load. Just a couple words about this site. This site is pictures of a model of the Beis HaMikdash. This model of Beis HaMikdash was built by a very known scholar in Yerushalayim, Azaman Kohen Shlita, and it's a magnificent model today. It can be seen in a place called the Kotel Tunnels near the Western Wall, near the Kotel, and what you can see here, if you take a look at it, this is the way he built. This is the way he designed the model of the Lishkas HaGozes, that room where the Sanhedrin sat. You can see two parts to the room. We're talking about the small room in front of the white building. The white building is the Heichal itself, and the small room in front is the Lishkas HaGozes. Now, half of it was outside the Azara on the right, and the other half was in the Azara. So you see that wall which runs down from behind the Heichal, runs down straight towards the doorway in front, which divides the room into two. Now, the side on the right, that's the western part, and that's where we have the apsis, and that's where the Sanhedrin sat. The Sanhedrin cannot sit inside the Azara because it's forbidden for anyone to sit in the Azara except a king from Malchei Beis David. So, therefore, the one on the right is the Sanhedrin sat in that edge of the basilica, while the functions which took place in the Azara were on the left side, which was inside the Azara. So there's an example of a basilica, a model of a basilica based on this source that we know, the Roman basilica based on the architecture. A couple words about the architecture. Should have said this at the beginning. A lot of the stuff we know about Roman architecture, like what does a basilica look like, is a book called Vitruvius on Architecture. Vitruvius on Architecture. Vitruvius was a first century architect. I don't have a link for it on the site, but it's available even on the web. It can be found. And Vitruvius was the first was an architect in the first century. And there's Julius Caesar and Augustus, and he wrote a book called a collection that he called 10 Books on Architecture. And he describes how to build certain buildings, how what materials to use, etc. Now this is available to it's been discovered in a few hundred years ago and been published. It's available in English. It's now been published in Hebrew. So we know a lot of these sources based on Vitruvius, his description of the basilica, which is one of the few, or maybe the only building that he ever built was a basilica. So we know to define a basilica based on this source. But again, as we said, it fits in with all the description of Chazal. I just mentioned that shuls Later were also built in the form of a basilica. The Gemara Circle will tell us that the great shul of Alexandria was also built like a basilica. And there's a shul in, excavated in Sardis in Turkey, where the form of the shul is exactly like a basilica with an apsis at the end. So that became style, and later on it became style for other buildings which were also built in the form of a basilica. We'll go on now to discuss bathhouses. The second thing that the servant is in awe is the bathhouse. Now, a couple words about a bathhouse. Before we understand today, I mean, it's obvious, it's common, it's expected for everyone to have one or two showers in the house. But in those days, with no running water, the creation of a bathhouse was a Roman creation which brought a major change to society. In order to have a good bathhouse, you also have to have running water. And that was the expertise of the Romans. With the aid of the concrete and the arches, they were able to bring water from distances to bring them to the city. Now, of course, there was no electric motors, so everything came by form of gravity, but they were able to make these aqueducts, to build these massive bridges and tunnels in order to collect the spring water and the rain water and bring it through the aqueducts to the city. There's a very interesting medrash, which is in the Hebrew sources 1.3, where I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it's there. It's a campaign promise. A malach bas avodam nichas medina. A king, a human king, comes into a state. Kol b'nei medina mekalsim elso. Everyone goes and praises him. Va'arav lo kinusam, and he likes the way they praise him. Amalam, he says, lemalach ani bona lachem dinusel to malchot tzelso. Tomorrow, since you guys are so nice, I'm going to build bathhouses for you. Lemalach ani machnis lachem amashal mayim. Tomorrow I will bring in an aqueduct. In other words, the power to do such construction is only in the hands of a king. Only public individuals cannot afford to do a thing like this. And in the end, Yashin lo v'lo amad. In the end, he went to sleep and he never kept his promises. So you see, politics haven't changed. But it's a campaign promise of a king to say that he's able to bring the aqueducts, and B, to create the bathhouses. Just for a couple pictures of aqueducts, source number 14 shows you an aerial picture of the aqueduct which brings water to Caesarea. You can see it beautifully here. These are actually two aqueducts, which you can see. There's the one in the foreground, which is the earlier aqueduct, and the one in the background, which is a later aqueduct. Both of them were brought to bring water to Caesarea. In the background of the picture, behind the houses, you can see hills. Those hills are the Carmel Mountains, and those hills are obviously higher than Caesarea, and that enabled them to bring the water from those hills, from the springs in those hills, through this aqueduct. It flowed by gravitation, right? By gravity, straight into the city. In the city, the water was used for a couple things. Of course, for drinking water, but the bathhouse, which was a major function in the Roman city. The aqueduct was built. We know inscriptions on the table was built by the 10th Legion. The 10th Roman Legion was active in Caesarea during the time that the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. The 10th Roman Legion destroyed the 2nd Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim. So we can assume that the aqueduct was built in the 1st or 2nd century at the latest. We also know that it was reinforced and repaired in the days of Hadrian. So again, we're talking 1st, 2nd century period, a typical Roman aqueduct. We didn't get to the double floors yet, so be patient. We'll get to that in a second. I don't want to discuss that. So we're discussing the aqueducts which enabled these bathhouses to work, and now we'll get to the bathhouse itself. Now we'll get to the bathhouse itself, and we'll talk about the invention. One of the biggest inventions of the Roman bathhouse was, as someone already mentioned, the double floors. to get to see a double floor, go into source number 18. And we'll start with source number 18. And this is the Roman bath that consisted of a few rooms. There was a dressing room. I'm not going to go into all the details of what they're called because it's just very time-consuming and time is very short. There was a dressing room, a cold room, which was actually a pool of cold water. There was a warm room.
Okay, we're back there.
Yeah, sorry. Look in source number 18. And source number 18 has two parts. The upper part is a reconstruction of a bathhouse which was found in a mountain called Kypros, one of the Herodian Hashmonai fortresses near Jericho, And what you can see is you can see a floor with tiles, and beneath it you can see a bunch of pillars holding up that floor. In the back, you see a bathtub, which was there the water was kept. And now go to the second part, to the bottom part. The bottom part is, has nothing to do with the top, but is a typical description of the Roman bathhouse. On the outside, on the left side, you see a furnace, which is sending heat. And the heat goes all the way underneath that floor. So anyone who's walking on that floor, you can imagine, will be very hot. And the heat also goes up the chutes. The chutes, which is number three in the diagram, goes up the chutes. So in essence, when a person walked into the hot room, he was in what's called a hippocouse. He was actually in a room within a room. In other words, it's a small room built within the large room, held up by these pillars. A person would take water from the bathtub and pour it on the floor, and that would create steam. And that was one of the major functions of the Roman bathhouse. One of the biggest dangers of entering such a bathhouse is that if the floor was not sturdy, it could collapse. And if the floor collapsed, the chances of survival were nil. A person would be burned to death, the chances are nil. And for that, I will refer you briefly to two sources in the Hebrew sources. Source number 2.1 in Hebrew. Shloshet Dvarim Tzivah Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Yehuda Es Rebbe. Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Yehuda commanded Rebbe three things. The first two are not important to us. Al Tetechi D'Balayla, don't walk out alone at night. V'al Tamod B'Pnan Ner Arum, don't stand in front of the candle without any clothing. And the third thing is, do not enter a new bathhouse. Meaning, if someone built a new bathhouse, you don't know, was it a good engineer, was it good construction, or not. So don't go into a new bathhouse, lest the floor might collapse. Ad kama, amav shebonev, ad yud beis chodesh. For 12 months, do not enter the bathhouse because you're in danger. We'll go to another source, the next source, 2.2, Brocha Samach. Tana Rabbana, Hanichmas v'beis ha-mechas omer, yiratzen l'fanach Hashem alakai, shetatzivei nizeum kayotziko. A person walks into a bathhouse, he should daven that Hashem should save him. And when we mean save him from the floor collapse. And as we see in the next line, Kinafik, when he exits the bathhouse, my omer, omer bacha, I thank you that you saved me from the fire. And then the Gemara tells a story about Rabbi Avo, Alabei Bani. Rabbi Avo entered a bathhouse. Ifchis Beibani Nitzitzen, the bathhouse collapsed beneath him. Yisrachash Le'nisa, a miracle occurred. Kamala Muda, a miracle occurred, and he was able to survive on a pillar, meaning one part of the floor, one pillar remained standing, and he was able to stand there. Shazid Me'er V'chad Gavri V'chad Ever, and he was able to hold on to a total of 101 people, one held on to the other, and to save them from dying in the bathhouse. Omar said, Hainu de Rabbi Acha. This is what Rabbi Acha said, in other words, this is the danger that Rabbi Acha was referring to when a person went to a bathhouse. The Yerushalmi in Brachot even says that when Rabbi Mana would go to a bathhouse, he would write a will to his family before he went because of the danger of going to a bathhouse. So this is a typical bathhouse, as you see here in the diagram. Now you can go, please, to source number 19, in the source page, and this is evidently the halachically was permissible to go in, but he took the precautions. So again, as you see, Chazal said, you know, it's dangerous. the affidavit, but, you know, okay, or, you know, or the percentage of danger, of danger, etc. Source number 19 is a picture of the bathhouse in Beit Sha'an. Today, a person who visits Beit Sha'an can see this bathhouse, and usually, almost 90% of the time, anything excavated, you will not find the upper floor. You can see this in Masada, you can see this in a bunch of places, you can see this in Sipori. The upper floor is going to collapse, so all you see is those pillars which held up the second floor. So, this, as we said, is a typical bathhouse. There are a few places where the bathhouse remains, even with the upper floor, but no good pictures of it, so you'll have to sell for this. So this is a typical Roman bathhouse. Now, the Roman bathhouse was not only for personal hygiene. The Roman bathhouse was also a thing of pleasure. A Roman would go to a bathhouse, he would spend half the day in the bathhouse. How long does it take for a person to take a shower? But he would spend half a day, he would work till noon or early afternoon, and then spend the rest of the day in the bathhouse. And there were some sports in the bathhouse, there was other things going on, lots of discussions probably in politics, but a full time in the bathhouse can take half a day. So much that the Gemara in Shabbos discusses the issue that a person cannot go to a bathhouse before he daven mincha, even if it's 12:30 in the afternoon, because if he's planning on staying there for a long time, he might stay in the bathhouse long enough until it's too late to daven mincha. So that is a typical Roman Roman bathhouse, which have been found in Eretz Yisrael and throughout the Roman and throughout the Roman Empire. Okay, we'll now go on to the next subject, and the next subject is theaters. I have a few sources over here. First of all, in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah refers to theaters. Take a look at the Hebrew sources 5.1. Darash of Shimon ben Pazi, Ashrei Ayish, Ashrei Lach V'Tatir, Shal Kakasar, Shal Av Dekachovim. Happy is the person who did not go to the theaters and the circuses of the grain. The theaters were a major entertainment place in practically every Roman city. If you go, for example, to source number eight, you will see a map of theaters that have been found. Of theaters that have been found throughout Eretz Yisrael, including the other side of the Jordan, and all these places, the list is in Hebrew, but it just gives you an idea of the areas where the where theaters have been discovered in excavations. I don't think we found all of them, but by no means. So theaters are common in any Roman city, even in cities where there's Jewish population, or mixture of Jewish population, I should say. Caesarea and Beit Sha'an are special that they are majority, vast majority, non-Jewish population. But there are other cities like Sipori, which is a mixture. And the theater existed there while other things did not, as we'll get to in a moment. So the theater, we'll go also to source number 9, which is a typical, which is a sketch of a typical Roman theater. The function of the Roman theater is for plays. It was a place where actors played out tragedies, comedy, etc. These things had a purpose. They were not just there by coincidence. The Romans took this opportunity by having everyone coming to the theater in order to preach their culture, to spread their culture. And the Roman culture, almost all the nations, succumbed to this idea, basically, and accepted the Roman culture. And one of the tools that they used was the theaters, the plays in the theaters. There were other things going on in the theaters. As we said, there's a very interesting source, which I will quote to you in sources 5.2. The source of it's a story about Rabbi Avohu. Now, just a couple words about Rabbi Avohu. Rabbi Avohu lived in the town, in the city of Caesarea. He lived in Caesarea. He's referred to in the Gemara in numerous places as very honored by the Roman government, by the Caesar. When he came, he was greeted, he was given the royal treatment. When he came to Caesarea, when he came to the Caesar, he was given the royal treatment. He was a very respected person, even by the non-Jews. And he moved into Syria. And in Chazal, we have very interesting, we have some very interesting stories with Rabbi Bro in reference to the theater. And did we show the aerial picture of the Syrian theater? No. 13? Did we show number 13? No. We'll go to source number 13. Source number 13 is a picture of the Roman theater in Caesarea. And it could be a little misleading in the picture because it seems like it's a full circle, but it's not really a full circle. It's a semicircle. The top semicircle is where the people are sitting, and then there's a wall. You're looking at it from the west, which means you're looking at it from behind the wall. The small semicircle in the front is not actually part of the theater. So don't get confused by that. That's a small addition that's for other functions. So this is the theater in Caesarea. What's interesting about this theater in Caesarea is that this is one place where we can actually pinpoint when Rabbi Avoh tells stories about what's going on in the theater. You can assume that this is where the this is where these incidents took place. This is where these plays took place. And source 5.2, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but just to give an example of a typical play, we have the story of Rabbi Avoh, who tells the story of a person who one of the actors comes on stage and he brings a camel. And the camel has his head bandaged as if he's like has a headache, or he's in mourning. And his friend says, "Why is the camel in mourning?" "Because my camel has nothing to eat." "Like, why does the camel have nothing to eat? I mean, what does the camel eat?" "He eats thorns." "Yes, but this year is a Shemitah year. And since this year is a Shemitah year, the Jews have nothing to eat. And since they have nothing to eat, they ate the thorns. And since the Jews ate the thorns, the camel has nothing to eat. And that's why he's in mourning." In other words, the idea of mocking the Jews was common in the Roman theaters. And this is the Moshe Leitzim. When the Gemara says you do not go to theaters because they are Moshe Leitzim, because it's Platonist. I mean, this is a typical example. But it's not just an example. It's not just hearsay. Rabbi Avoh lived in this area, and he probably, I can't say personally witnessed it, but he was there, and he knew what was going on. So this is an example. We'll get to, hopefully, time permitting, we'll get to Rabbi Avoh and discuss him also in Caesarea. But this is the Roman theater. We'll go back to the typical Roman theater. And here you just see, okay, I'm not going to go into all the functions and all the names of the all the names of the different parts of the Roman theater. But as you can see, and what's important to remember, is that it's a semicircle. It's for actors, and of course actors are not going to perform in a complete circle because then they have their backs to half the crowd. So they're performing in a semicircle, and that is a theater. The second part, when we talk about the Roman structures of entertainment, you have theaters, and in the Gemara, you have stadiums, which are called itstadionim. And take a look in the Hebrew sources, 4.1, the Hebrew sources. Halachically, itstadionim, a person who goes to a stadium. The Rosh Hashanah Nachashim, he sees the snakes, there's the Chaverim, Bukyon, Amukyon, Amulyon, in other words, all types of clowns, all types of different. This is a stadium. And a stadium is not a semicircle. A stadium is either an oval, a long oval structure, which sometimes function for as a hippodrome for horse racing, and you also had a concept of an itstadionim, which was a full circle, which is called an amphitheater. The amphitheater is pretty much a full circle. These are not the theaters, and don't make that mistake. And what's important to distinguish is not only that they're different, but the functions are majorly different. The amphitheaters are used for gladiator fights. And the gladiator fights are not always the gladiator fights. Sometimes are professional gladiators who are fighting animals for entertainment or fighting other gladiators, and sometimes they're prisoners who are thrown to the animals, of course, with no chance of survival. If you'll bring up now the aerial picture of Caesarea, the beautiful picture, source number 5, to bring up this aerial picture, just a couple words about it. It's an older aerial picture, a beautiful picture. It does not. I took it from a friend of mine whose name is Richard Klee from Cyprus, and he permitted me to use this picture today. It's a beautiful aerial picture of Caesarea. So there has been excavated more since then. The other two sources, which will show you the map, this is area 6 and 7, but I'm going to focus now on the on this photo, which is source number 5, which you can see here. And it's taking a couple seconds to load, because it's a big picture.
They call it an amphitheater. They can't find
it. Which?
Or were there
two? There are two. That's exactly the point. There's a theater, which will not be visible in this picture. In a moment, we'll take you to the map of the city of Caesarea, and you'll see the difference with the theater and the amphitheater. The theater is not visible in this picture, which is source number 5. What you see on the left, A, you see the harbor, the Caesarea Harbor, which was the pride and joy of the city of Caesarea, which we can talk about a lot. We will not talk about that now. To the left of it is below is the old hippodrome, which has been recently excavated, and today one can go in it. The hippodrome served for horse races, but at times they took the hippodrome and converted it to function also for the gladiator fights. We know from Josephus that when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, the Romans, after destroying the Beis HaMikdash, Titus came to Caesarea, and he celebrated his brother's birthday party by throwing 2,500 Jewish prisoners to the animals in the amphitheater at Caesarea. Now, hippodrome amphitheater in those days, they were one, and it's probably in the old hippodrome, which you can see to the left, which I marked to the left, although, again, it's been excavated since we know it's there. Take a look in the yellow. I have CW1, which means City Wall 1. That was the Roman wall around the harbor of Caesarea. And on the right side of the picture, in red, you have CW2, which is the City Wall 2, which is the Byzantine period. So, which is the Byzantine period. You also see over here the hippodrome, which you can tell by the way the buildings are built that there is a hippodrome. It hasn't been excavated. But in the center of the hippodrome, there was a major obelisk, which has been reconstructed. And the obelisk is source number 12. There's a picture of it. It's been reconstructed. It will give you an idea of how tall that stood. So again, there's the theater, and there is the amphitheater, which are two separate functions. And in the Gemara, for example, which source number 4, too, the time in Hochim Eitz Tadinin, you don't go to the Eitz Tadinin, and the Bach and the other gears, the Israel nation, Shofchei Damin, because they are murderers. In other words, it's not usual going to the theater where it's just a question of Leitonus, a question of Makkali, but it's a question of murder. You're participating in enjoying, cheering on, that they're throwing people to the lions. You are participating in the crime. However, Rabbi Nassim Matir of Mishneh Dvarim, Rabbi Nassim nonetheless permits going to such things for two purposes. One with Nesha Tzavach Umatu. One is he might be able to scream and save the poor person. You know, the people will have mercy and save the poor person. And the second issue is Nesha Meud Avis Ishal Asiyah. If a poor Jew was thrown there and there's no witnesses that he was killed, then his wife will never be able to remarry. And for that reason, Rabbi Nassim says you're allowed to go just to testify the mere fact that this person has been killed so that his wife can remarry. All these fields belong to the nearby kibbutz and have yet to be excavated. But you can see the way the trees have been put over there is not a coincidence. In other words, it turns out that underneath the hippodrome is there. And likewise, if you see the green where I wrote the amphitheater, you see a round circle over there. It also has not been excavated. But we know that the amphitheater is there because it matches the description of an amphitheater. What are the two? Okay, let's not get into that. It's really not relevant because there's an old hippodrome and the sea washed it away. Eventually, they built another one in a later period. So these are the two functions. I have over here a picture. Let's go to source 21. Is a picture of the amphitheater in Beit Guvrin. Beit Guvrin is a town south of Beit Shemesh. Not much of it remains today, but it was also a major Roman city. Not a lot of it has been excavated, But about 10 years ago, I was 21. A couple of years ago, they did excavate an amphitheater. And the amphitheater was used, again, for gladiator shows. It was not used for horse races. It's round. It's perfectly round. And if you take a look at the picture here, you will see, on the top of the picture, you'll see that a round structure. And in the center of the picture, you'll see two grooves crisscrossing each other. Now, these grooves are underground tunnels, which were used for the animals to pop up out of nowhere, or the slaves or the prisoners were thrown to the lions through these underground grooves. If anyone has ever been or seen a picture of the Colosseum in Rome, all you see from the floor is a bunch of those grooves, because the floor itself is non-existent, and the floor itself is non-existent. All that remained of those grooves were used to build it for the animals to come out suddenly. But, one of the major differences between the theater and the amphitheater, again, the function, but to the floor. The floor of the theater was marble, while the floor of the amphitheater was sand. And the word commonly used today as arena means sand. And the purpose of the sand is, of course, for the blood of the people killed there to be absorbed in the ground. And that's why the floor is sand and not marble. So that's a major difference between the theater and the amphitheater. Time is running out. So we'll leave some for next time. But I'll just mention a couple words about the amphitheater entrance area. We know that one of the Asara Haruge Malchus, one of the 10 martyrs who were killed by the Romans, was Rabbi Akiva. And from sources, various sources, we know that Rabbi Akiva was tortured to death in Caesarea. He was tortured to death in Caesarea, and it's in one of those three, either in the old Hippodrome or the new one, or the amphitheater, one of those places is probably where Rabbi Akiva was tortured to death. Now, the sources also mention two interesting things which are typical in every Roman city. One, there's a source that Rabbi Akiva was buried in a place called the Tetrapilion of Caesarea. And for many years in the Middle Ages, the Jews in Caesarea believed that Rabbi Akiva, they used to show the obelisk that we showed as the kever of where Rabbi Akiva is buried. And it mentions that he's buried in the Tetrapilion. What is the Tetrapilion? The Tetrapilion is actually the main square of the city. Every Roman city was divided by two main streets. There was the Tardo Maxima, which was the main street which ran east-west, and the Decumanus, which ran north-south. And at the center, they merge in a place called the Tetrapilion. We have a picture of a drawing of the Tetrapilion of Geresh, number 10. And that's a top. That's the top of, that's a sketch of the one Geresh. Geresh is a city in Jordan today. It's one of the best preserved Roman cities. So this is the Tetrapilion as looked from above. Tet meaning four, like a four gates. So on the top you see a sketch of what was excavated. And if you go down, you will see a an artist's reconstruction of what the thing looked like. So this is a typical, structure that appeared in every Roman city called the Tetrapilion, and we know there was one in Caesarea. We don't know where it is today. It has been found, but we know also from another source that there were dead bodies buried in that vicinity. So it shouldn't be surprising this source that Rabbi Akiva was buried over there. The Gemara also tells us in Menachos, and that source 9:1 on the Hebrew, it tells us that it's a very interesting story. I will not go into the whole story because time is not permitting, but it tells us that Rabbi Akiva, that Moshe Rabbeinu, when he went up to Shemayim to see the Torah, he visioned Rabbi Akiva giving the shir. And after, he was amazed and fascinated by the depth that Rabbi Akiva reached. And finally he said to Ribbono Shel Olam, Hirishani Toraso, you showed me his Torah, Haleini Sechoro, I want to see his rewards. So Chazal Achorav, Rosh Shokun Besar B'Makulin, he saw that they are weighing his flesh in a place called the Makulin. We're not going to explain this Gemara because this Gemara has to be explained in depth exactly what the Gemara is saying. But the point is, it mentions a particular place called a Makulin. Makulin, as Rashi already points out over there, is the meat market. And indeed, it is the Roman word for meat market called Makelum. And if you look at source number 24, it's the Makelum in Pompeii, which, of course, is one of the best preserved Roman cities because it was destroyed by It was destroyed by a volcano, was covered by a volcano, and excavated in the last 150 years. So the meat market, which is a typical round, those small structures in a round circle, is a typical meat market called McKellum. So there's one in Gerrish also, the city which we mentioned moments ago, and that's the way it looks. So that is a again another item has yet to be found in Caesarea. I can't say unfortunately, but I'm saying the central part of Caesarea is a little hard to excavate because the Crusaders built their own city on top and probably destroyed a lot of the stuff underneath. So some stuff is in Caesarea, like the bathhouse, the hippodrome, the theater. Some stuff has yet to be found. Maybe will, maybe not. Okay, we'll do one more source which also has to do with the Gemara, and that's the source of the fountains. And if you take a look at the Hebrew sources, source number 6-1, it mentions faces that are shooting out water into major cities. He should not put his mouth on the mouth. In other words, if you drink from these fountains, which are actually faces, so then it looks like you're kissing. It looks like you're kissing Avodah Zarah. And this is typical. Any Roman, first of all, any Roman city had a place called an Infaeum, which was a water fountain, which had lots of water flowing. But this was typical that all these fountains came from mouths of animals or gods or stuff like that. And what's interesting is, I'll mention one more place for tonight, a place called Hamat Gader. Hamat Gader is near the Kinneret, near Tiberia. And there are a couple sources here for Hamat Gader, source number 2 and number 3, which talk about the baths. The Roman baths which have been found at Hamat Gader. And in source number 3, it's a reconstruction of one of the largest pools that has been found. Now these baths, we know were frequented by Chazal because the Medrash in Koheles mentions certain examples. Live examples is, did you go to Hamat Gader in your life? Was there a lot of food there? Was there stuff available? No, it was very common. A shul has been excavated in Hamat Gader, and the mosaic floors list of people who donated money, and it has people who donated money from lots of towns in the vicinity, not only locally. In other words, people came to bathe there, and to bathe in these hot baths, these natural hot springs in Hamat Gader to this very day. People came to bathe there, and in the time of Chazal too. Now what's interesting with these fountains is that these fountains all had images on them. And when they were excavated, though, the images have been destroyed. Because when the Muslims captured the country in 638, so they defaced all these images because you do not find in the Muslim art any images of human beings or idols or stuff like that. In the Byzantine period, they were no longer worshipping idols. But they kept the images. The images were okay as long as they weren't worshipped. And the Muslims defaced the stuff. And that's why when the Muslims captured the country in 638 and they used these baths, which, by the way, they rated number 2 in the Roman Empire, these baths. Now, there was second, the number 1 baths were somewhere in Italy, and number 2 baths were these baths over here in Hamat Gader. And so these fountains, I even have a picture, if you look at number 4, it's a picture of a modern fountain with a faucet coming out of an image. And in the Roman fountain, you probably didn't have that faucet, but you had the water flowing out, and that is what the Mishnah forbids. That is what the Gemara forbids to drink from, because it seems like you are kissing. Even though that's not your intention, but you cannot drink. I just want to end off with a small story. I mentioned to you that the Roman theaters were there to spread their culture, and the only people who actually resisted, but succeeded in resisting, are the Jewish people. And there's a fascinating story in the Septa in the Halos, Perek Yud Ches. It tells the story of the Shemitah year, and the Romans went to their theater, and everyone went to the play. And the only people who didn't go were the Jews. And the Romans left the marketplaces open with all the fruits, because they had nothing to fear, because all the non-Jewish population was at the theater, while the Jewish population would not eat the fruits, because it's the Shemitah year and the fruits are forbidden. And that day, the people in the Beit HaMikdash decided, and I'm not going to go into explanation of this, but they decided that Caesarea and vicinity do not have Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, and the fruits are permissible. And all the Jews who did not go to the theater, they went and looted all the fruits that are in the Roman marketplace, because the Romans left it alone. And The point is that the Jews were able to resist, despite the temptation, despite the overwhelming coma of Russia, the Jews were able to resist and fight and survive. And if the Jewish people around today, it's because the Jews then were able to resist. But as we know, in today's day and age, we're facing similar trials. Again, not defeatists directly, but the same idea with some people who try to force their beliefs and their morals upon us with all types of media and stuff like that. And that is our job, again, to withstand this and to overcome that too.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Landy. That was an absolutely amazing and eye-opening lecture. Bezat Hashem, we'll be back next week and we'll post for you Mari Makamot and the planned titles for the lectures next week. We should have next week an in-depth look at the Masechta Dafayomi, preceded by a short introduction on the Parsha, as we've been doing in the past week. Thank you very much, and Richard.